When you hear a countertenor, you might think there are women in the ensemble, but it actually is a group of 12 male singers. More than half of them are countertenors. That's what makes the sound so unique with the ensemble Chanticleer. You're also going to find out about their music director, who never makes it to the stage. All those details and more in this edition of New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Almacher. Enjoy. So how long have each of you been part of Chanticleer's 40-year history?
This is Jared. This is my fourth season. My story is a little untraditional in that I started mid-year. I started in January of 2016, so mid-season. Our season starts in August. And so I haven't been in the ensemble 3 calendar years yet, but this is my fourth season.
And this is Alan. This is my 13th season with the group.
So, Jared, you have said that being part of this ensemble has been a dream come true for you. Why is that?
I remember hearing Chanticleer when I was a student at the University of Wisconsin, and I had never heard of Chanticleer before. And I was blown away by what I saw, and I said, I want to be part of that group. It took a while, but it happened, and it was a dream that I forgot about. I left Wisconsin with an education degree, and I started to pursue singing seriously, solo singing seriously. And so I got a degree in vocal performance and started doing a lot more solo gigs. I moved to Boston and did a lot of singing there, and I kind of forgot about Chanticleer. And then the opportunity arose, and it was like a dream I had forgotten about. And so I took advantage of it. It still is a dream come true for me.
And you're also the assistant music director. What does that mean? Mm-hmm.
So we do have a music director who chooses our music and basically schedules most things musicals for us. So in addition to some administrative duties that I have, which are boring and exhausting, whenever we're on the road and in the event that our music director can't be with us, I'm kind of the point person for things musical. I would lead rehearsals when our music director can't be there. I kind of help to arbitrate musical decisions. Sometimes I serve as an intermediary between the ensemble and our music director. So I'm just, I'm still one of the guys, but I get to kind of tell him what to do when our director's not around.
Your 40th anniversary recording is really indicative of the ensemble's wide-ranging repertoire. Can you talk a little bit about how that repertoire has evolved over the years?
Certainly. This is Jared. Chanticleer was founded by a man named Louis Botto, who was studying early music at Dominican University out here in the Bay Area. And he was struck that he was studying early music and nobody was really performing it. And he was interested to know what it would sound like if you took a piece that was written for a choir of men and boys, like, say, the William Byrd Ave Verum Corpus, and what would it sound like if men sang it and not a mixed ensemble of men and women. And so he and a lot of his colleagues from San Francisco Symphony Chorus and Grace Cathedral got together. I think there were eight or nine at that first meeting, kind of sat around a table and sang these things, and were struck by how different it sounded and how neat it sounded. In the middle of mid-1980s, when Joe Jennings really started to become a major figure in the ensemble, did things like folk songs, spirituals, gospels, less Renaissance-y type things started to be incorporated into the repertoire. Joe actually did a lot of arrangements for the ensemble, and we still sing a lot of those arrangements today. And then, you know, in the 90s and 2000s, we were doing things like pop songs and newly commissioned works and, you know, everything under the sun that 12 guys can sing, we do. As long as our voices can sing all the notes, we try to sing it. We don't really think that there are any limits.
That Renaissance music, though, is still at the core of what you do. How do you choose that repertoire?
Well, we have our music director. One of his main responsibilities is to pick the music that we're going to sing, and he's the master behind our programming, and you know he's done an amazing job with kind of artfully assembling various pieces throughout the entire choral repertoire, not just Renaissance. We don't have a ton of say in terms of what we sing. Occasionally, he will reach out to us and ask us our opinions on certain pieces, which pieces, you know, are we dying to do again or whatnot. But it's mostly up to our music director, William Fred Scott.
We should talk a little bit about him because that's kind of an unusual situation in that you have a conductor who is never seen.
This is Jared. Yeah, and it's a very interesting setup. Fred, our current music director, Fred, has a history of being in front of an opera orchestra. He was with the Atlanta Opera for several decades. And for someone to go from doing that to literally having a spotlight to yourself and then to be in front of an ensemble that you never get to technically be in front of on stage, it takes a big person to be comfortable enough with himself to allow that to happen. There are some times where we can tell that Fred would really love nothing more than to be on stage with us, but that's not part of the job. So it's really, you know, Fred has to give us all of his musical knowledge before we get on stage, and it's our job as the ensemble to give the audience kind of his musical vision. It is a very, very interesting model because it actually turns away, I don't think I'm out of line saying this, but it does turn away a lot of potential candidates who would take that job because they will never get any stage time.
And he is someone that you actually pursued for a very long time, and then he finally sort of gave in, if you will.
This is Alan. It was an interesting courtship because, you know, I've been in the group now. This is my 13th year, and almost from the beginning, he was in our periphery, and he was served as a, I guess you'd kind of call him like a consultant. We would go to him occasionally for guest artist or guest music director projects. But yeah, initially he kind of served to help us, you know, find a director. And then he said, oh, you know, I'll just throw my name in the hat after all.
You and Jared are both countertenors. What does that mean?
This is Alan. So it's basically any man who sings in his falsetto register. And there are, I guess, different opinions out there in terms of how to properly define what falsetto is. But simply put, when a man goes, you know, through his voice change and he begins to sing in his quote-unquote chest voice, which is where the tenors and basses sing, and where most people are accustomed to hearing men sing, most men actually still have access to a higher part of their voice, and that's called the falsetto, or the countertenor register. And physiologically, what's happening is that in the chest register, the vocal folds are coming completely together to make a full sound, whereas when a man sings in his falsetto, there's only a portion of the vocal folds that are coming together. And it's a very, very unique sound.
Now, there are 12 singers in Chanticleer, and half of you are countertenors. Is that right?
That's correct.
So that's a very key sound to what Chanticleer does.
It is. And, you know, it's funny when oftentimes if you've never heard Chanticleer before, if you close your eyes, if you're listening to us on a recording, you'd swear that some of the singers were women. But that's not the case. We have a very, very unique sound.
I want to talk a little bit more about the repertoire on this recording called Then and There, Here and Now. And it's really a retrospective, and it kind of covers all the bases, if you will. There is one piece in particular that I'm wondering if you can share the story about, and it is one of those early music pieces by Antonio de Salazar. It's called Salve Regina, and it was prepared specifically for Chanticleer to perform. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. This is Alan. We have an amazing colleague in the name of Craig Russell, who's down, I believe, at San Luis Obispo. He's a musicologist professor there, and he has a passion for that kind of music, which I guess you'd say Mexican Baroque. He's been to Mexico many, many times, searching for music and trying to get authentic editions published. It's been a long, long, wonderful partnership, and he brought us this piece. I believe the first time I sang it was, I don't know, maybe 7 years ago, and we were just immediately in awe of it. It's a double choir piece, meaning the choir is split into a group of four and a group of eight. And there are parts where there are moments in the piece where we're kind of trading off and doing some call and response and echo effects. And it's so interesting because you can tell that the composer is just a little bit unpolished in a way that his European contemporaries would maybe scoff at or not approve of, but those are the kinds of flavors that make it so unique and so fun and so interesting to us. And we were so thrilled when we learned that it made it to the list of what we were going to put on this album.
Joseph Jennings was your music director for 25 years, and his specialty was in African-American jazz. And he created, 100 arrangements or so for the ensemble, and some of those appear on this recording. Could you talk about some of those pieces and why they're so well-suited for Chanticleer?
This is Jared. The two pieces on this recording are Straight Street, which is an old gospel tune, and Keep Your Hand on the Plow, which is a spiritual. And I think what makes these pieces so well-suited for Chanticleer is that Joe wrote them for specific voices in the ensemble. Straight Street is definitely a call and response, you know, kind of get up and praise the Lord kind of piece. And Joe sang with the group when they performed these pieces originally. In the case of Straight Street, there was no music written down. Everything was learned by rote. Joe would sing something, and the ensemble would sing it back to him, and they would just kind of piece it together like that. And I don't think that there are many ensembles anymore that do that much. And I think what that means is that the singers internalize the music so much more than just reading the notes off of a page.
This is Alan. And I was lucky enough to work with him for a couple years when I first joined in 2006. He was still music director. And I'll never forget those moments when he would come out, usually towards the end of our concerts and for the encores, for example, and he would just take the stage and we were all his, almost like the backup singers in Joe, you know. But we learned so much from him just by watching him perform and the energy that he provided. And there's that sense of fun and that sense of letting go and trusting each other, trusting your own voice. Those were the big lessons that I learned from him.
So if each of you had to pick one or maybe two favorites that appear on this recording, what would they be and why?
This is Alan. Yeah, I would say the Mason Bates selection is one of the highlights for me. And, you know, every once in a while we get a composer who just really, really gets us. And Mason has always seemed to come up with compositions that are just the right level of difficulty, but doable. You know, once we kind of wrap our brains around them, there's an elegance to them and there's an ease which, you know, more often than not, when we receive a modern commission, there's sometimes hurdles that are just not possible to overcome. We have to kind of work around certain things. But with Mason's music, it doesn't ever seem to be the case. And it's just a breath of fresh air to be able to, you know, continually sing pieces by him, because it's been, I mean, I've sung now maybe four or five different Mason Bates compositions, and like I said, every single one, it's been a joy.
This is Jared. I would have to say that my favorite piece on this album is the Stephen Stuckey Whispers. It's a fascinating piece that was very interesting. Actually, the physical recording of it in the studio was very interesting to me. We had one studio, but it's a double choir piece. There's a quartet of soloists who sing Ave Verum Corpus while an octet of us sing this very ethereal text by Walt Whitman, which talks about, you know, crossing over to the other side, if you will. And in the studio, there were, you know, panels and soundboards and dividers and plastic window sheets up all over the place, and 65 different, you know, microphones everywhere, and couldn't see anybody. And it was, but then to listen to it on the album is just, you don't even know any of that. It's, maybe I gave away the smoke and mirrors, but I just think it's such a moving piece. And if I could just share a story, that we just did this piece on our concert in Atlanta a couple weeks ago, and a woman came up to me afterwards and she said, I don't know if Stephen Stuckey had a near-death experience, but she said, I was hospitalized for a time, and there were several times that I slipped in and out of consciousness, and I, you know, had near-death experiences. And when you all sang that Whisper song, that's what I heard. I heard these fragments of pieces that I knew juxtaposed with these very wispy, kind of ethereal, nonsensical sounds. And she said it was very striking to me to hear that. And for us as performers to hear that is very powerful, because, you know, to us it's like, well, I just look down on the page and just sing the notes. But, you know, just to an audience member who has no idea, it's a really moving experience. And I'm glad she told me that.
Oh, that's a great story. Thank you for sharing that. What have each of you learned about yourself in being part of this ensemble?
Well, this is Alan. I think the biggest thing that I've learned about myself being in Chanticleer is a level of poise. Both I discover on stage that I have kind of incorporated into my own person in my everyday life. It can be very frightening to be on stage, and sometimes the nerves can get the best of us, even the more seasoned singers. But there are so many lessons to be taken from that. And once those initial butterflies subside, being on stage with 11 other singers, you know, creating the most beautiful music that you're able to create for people, you know, kind of teaches you. It's a kind of humility and a contribution to the world that I try to kind of incorporate in every aspect of my life, if that makes any sense.
Oh, it makes a lot of sense.
This is Jared. This job has taught me that I can do a lot more than I think. When I came out here to sing with Chanticleer, I was put in a soprano position, and up until that point I had not sung soprano since I was probably 7 years old. So that was a big growing moment for me. But also just that, you know, everyone says it's such a demanding, rigorous schedule, and it is, don't get me wrong, it is, but I thought, you know, when I came on board, I'll never be able to measure up. I don't think I can sing 5 concerts in a week. I don't think I can sing 25 Christmas concerts, you know, in as many days. But I can, and I've done it, and I've been doing it. And I think that what this job has taught me is that I can do whatever I want, in a sense. You know, I don't have to let my own arbitrary limitations hold me back. And I continue to feel that I'm still growing as a musician, even though I've been singing for, you know, 25 years. So it is to kind of also echo what Alan said, it is a bit of a humbling and at times humiliating a position, because, and also, you know, just when you think you got it, you know, the rug gets pulled out from underneath you and you're back at square one.
That's New Classical Tracks from American Public Media, with special thanks to Elena C. for producing this episode. I'm Julia Macher.